arteries. The Vietnamese may be able to move into the delta areas and using the very tactics of the other side, dislodge the VC and the NVNA. This will mean, of course, that the South Vietnamese will have to become guerrillas. We haven't heard anything about that happening or any plans for it. It's something to keep in mind and ask about during the next days. I have the impression that they are building up power along American lines, power based on technological superiority of ships and weapons, and even, of course, aircraft. A question, incidentally, which I asked yesterday about why it is the North Vietnamese, who do possess pretty strong air power, are never heard of attacking south of the DMZ, was answered very simply. The defensive positions of the South Vietnamese Army and Air Force are so strong that no North Vietnamese plane has been able to penetrate them at all. It's true also that at night I hear what some of the American naval officers tell me is probably the sound of B-52 strikes 10 miles or so from Saigon. It's very strange to think of these super fortresses, strategic bombers meant for much more formidable tasks, being used against, as we were told, the typical target is a supply dump of VC guerrillas. In our observation, the American officers get along extremely well with their Vietnamese counterparts. A naval lieutenant told me that there was trouble in the days when there were huge numbers of American draftee soldiers here who had no indoctrination, who were taking heavy casualties and who fell into the habit of dislike and worse for the Vietnamese in general. He tells me that today officers are arriving who have had 6 months of Vietnamese language training and other kinds of preparation before they come, and that the attitude of the officers currently is one of understanding and appreciation and of real friendship with the Vietnamese. What he said was borne out by what we could observe as we went along, a mixed party of Vietnamese officers, American officers, and three civilians today, Bill, a Swedish journalist, and myself, along with the unlikely-looking figure of Mrs. Zung in her Ao Dai, clinging to our tiny warship as it zoomed around in the during the naval demonstration. This is Thursday, January 12th.
This morning, we got aboard a helicopter at Bien Ho and went up to An Loc, the town that withstood a siege that lasted 70 days. Miss Lien, who runs the Council on Foreign Relations and has been making all arrangements for us with the utmost kindness, wanted to go with us. This is a Buddhist holiday, and she doesn't have to work. She arrived in a trim suit and got as far as Bien Ho. They wouldn't let her go. The situation is that An Loc, perhaps 40 miles north and a little west of Saigon, is surrounded by North Vietnamese troops. The road on which there was so much fighting is open a bit beyond Bien Ho, but then beyond that it is not open, although it was opened at one point when the siege was lifted last spring. It's a mystery, really, why the North Vietnamese put such tremendous effort into trying to take An Loc and now have fallen back and yet hold a ring of positions that produce daily contacts, daily operations out of An Loc. So one must go by helicopter simply to skip over the area that is dangerous. We had a wonderful view. It was a beautiful day. Close to Saigon, rice fields harvested. Beyond that, a good deal of defoliation. But a most interesting thing is that the defoliated areas are recuperating. We saw rubber forests, which obviously had been completely defoliated. Many branches were still bare, but strong new shoots were coming out, and one imagines that the rubber forest will recover within a few years. On both sides of every road, small and large, almost every road, there is a defoliated strip. But these strips also have green cover. And one can see here and there how the green is creeping and strengthening its hold once more on the soil. In a vast ring around An Loc, there are countless bomb craters. They seem surprisingly small to me. All the same, an awful lot of them. We flew at 3,000 feet with both with the doors on both sides wide open and a gunner on each side with a machine gun ready. Two pilots, all of these Vietnamese. Then we had a Vietnamese public relations officer going with us. And we brought with us, back with us, one of the, a captain who had fought through the siege and who has studied at Fort Bragg. He's a captain, but he has not finished high school. When he gets out, he told me he intends to finish high school and go to college. He speaks English extremely well, and French also. Well, it was rather chilly with the wind blowing through the helicopter as we tried to seem not to cling too tightly to the metal seats. But they're a wonderful machine, landing so lightly in the precise spot the pilot chooses. Up in the air, far too much noise and vibration, not to mention the wind in this case, for any pleasure, except the pleasure of seeing, looking down and having this extraordinary view of the landscape, a flat landscape, with the exception of perhaps three or four perfectly conical mountains rising straight out of it. Some smaller hills were being quarried and stone broken up into gravel, and a great deal of sand is being excavated, a building going on. But the great site was Anlach. As Bill said, when the South Vietnamese finally proved that they could hold out and really defeated the attack of the North Vietnamese, the news of Anlach disappeared from our newspapers. But there it is, a site to be compared with Pompeii, although it's scarcely 6 months old. A ruined city of some 30,000 people. We've walked around at great length. Besides the obvious ruins of buildings everywhere, the most amazing sight was that of enormous Russian-made tanks, turrets 3 and 4 inches thick, as one could see where the turrets had been pierced by rockets. And these tanks, sometimes 3 or 4 in a line, stopped in their tracks, coming up a slope into the town, in the streets of the town, stopped, killed, and rusting away. They already look, as the Joker said, one with Nineveh and Tyre. The people make a great deal of the fact that the two Buddhist temples were not severely damaged. The roofs and some of the supports, more in the one case than the other, but the Buddha figure at the center, untouched in one case, almost untouched in the other. One of the temples functioning with a monk or a priest, who was not there today, but his wife was there, and began to haul out the teapot and so forth until we explained that we had to hurry. It means a great deal to the Vietnamese that these Buddhist temples were not destroyed. They regard it as a miracle. Someone else might regard it as an accident. Still, it's strange because there are no other buildings that are preserved to the same extent. And the firing was of such a wild character that it couldn't be by intent, because everything around has been hit innumerable times. Even the brand new 3-story high school three-sided building with a courtyard in which there are basketball courts and so on. Even that heavy cast concrete building turned into a Swiss cheese. Now there are about 300 people still living in An Lạc. The government did not push them out, only if they wanted to go. And these didn't want to go. They're mostly elderly people. And they live in half-broken houses in tiny little areas where they can get a little shelter. A few of them even present little tables with fruit, which the garrison buys. Weeds, some of them flowering weeds, growing everywhere where obviously pavement and curbstone prevailed before. Parachutes used as quite beautiful circular tents. Every manner of makeshift for those who are staying there. There is a garrison, and the captain joined us. He couldn't speak English, but he was very pleasant and wanted us to see more than we had time for. The Vietnamese are extremely proud of An Lạc. I gather that this is where the Vietnamese army proved itself, proved that it could stand up to the North Vietnamese. And it was not a matter of mere superiority of weapons provided by the United States. The South Vietnamese have nothing resembling the enormous tanks that the Russians used in their attack on An Lạc. They did have something to compensate. They could call in airstrikes. The two sides, Russia helping the North Vietnam and the United States helping South Vietnam, restrict their help in very particular ways and restrict their help in different ways. But both sides give their allies what they think they will need for a particular occasion. And we, most of all now, are of course turning over to the South Vietnamese weapons on an entirely new scale. One can pick up in the weeds endless detritus of war, including unexpended machine gun shells. Burnt out vehicles are scattered here and there, everywhere. I have never seen such a sight, a ruined city, since I saw Pompeii. We sat to rest in the briefing room of the commanding officer. Fortunately, instead of briefing, we had Coca-Cola, which is what we needed, although we hated to take it, since all supplies come in by air, either by helicopters which land, like the Chinooks, or more commonly, supplies are dropped by parachute. In fact, we were just walking into the courtyard of the commanding officer's quarters when an air alarm sounded, but this meant merely that you were in danger of being conked on the head by a box full of supplies dropped by parachute. We watched these supplies come down, and all this is routine for the garrison. They even receive movies and other recreational material in this way. They also get four days leave every month when they fly out to Saigon or wherever they want to go from Saigon. We saw devastation today. I suspect on a scale that can't be matched elsewhere. But we didn't see any unhappiness about this devastation. On the contrary, we saw pride. We saw individual graves. The military ones attended to much better than the civilian ones. And we also saw mass graves with 100 to 400 buried in one grave. And we were told that VC and civilians and South Vietnamese soldiers were all buried together in the emergency of the siege. They're well cared for, and I suspect they will be monuments someday, even a sort of park. Two questions suggest themselves. The first is why it is that the South Vietnamese, having shown such extraordinary power in holding out at An Loc and destroying the offensive weapons of the enemy, including those great tanks, something like 30 of them all told, why the South Vietnamese can't lift the VNA control of the road and of the perimeter around An Loc. As far as I can make out, the answer is that they just don't have the troops. The North Vietnamese don't have the strength to renew the siege, but on the other hand, the South Vietnamese don't have the troops, the strength, that is, to widen their circle of control. At present, they hold not only the city, but a perimeter around it of approximately a mile, while beyond that mile, there are constant contacts and small actions between the two sides. The South Vietnamese need troops in the north, where the North Vietnamese are engaged in major offensives and have to sacrifice the situation, many situations, in the center and in the south. In other words, this is a very dramatic picture of stalemate that we saw today. The sort of stalemate which is one of the, perhaps the basic reason why we are engaged in negotiations with the North in Paris at present. Meanwhile, more leopard spots for the negotiators to try to work out. And if there is a ceasefire for the two sides to deal with, each in its own way. The other question concerns the importance of Ann Locke to both sides, the reason why both sides committed so much power to take or to hold Ann Locke. The best explanation of this that I could get from the officers with us is that Ann Locke is an important position on the way to Saigon. And so the other side was determined to take it, the South Vietnamese side determined to hold it. And what is the true situation, since Ann Locke, after all, as a city, has virtually ceased to exist? Well, there's a leopard spot up there, which is controlled by a garrison of South Vietnamese. That's all one can find out. This is Friday, January 13. Bill went to see someone about an organization he's interested in that wants to adopt children from this country this morning, and I took it easy. In the afternoon, we called upon a representative of the NVQDD party in his quite attractive house and had a long political talk with him. He belongs to the opposition, the very loyal opposition. And he gave us his views on the prospects of peace. He's very doubtful about a number of the items in the arrangement we've heard about. He has the mind of a lawyer, which he is, and analyzes his views very exactly. Very lively intelligence, a very sharp person. He was very kind to me, told us how he remembers many episodes dating back to the Roosevelt period, and would be quite willing to talk to me again. I must get his address from the program that Miss Lien typed up for Bill, his name and address. Then we went to call upon Nguyen Ngoc Linh, who is apparently one of the most important businessmen in South Vietnam. He's chairman of the board of the Mekong Group of Companies, apparently a conglomerate that includes things like the Ford Agency for South Vietnam, many other things. He's interested, furthermore, in the new Mekong University that's being organized. He is, in fact, the brother of Bic, working directly for that university, and the captain, the two men who took us to the country last Sunday. It was astounding to Bill and to me that they had not told us that they were brothers. A really surprising thing about Mr. Lin is that he's concerned to organize an oral history project on the lines of our oral history programs. That is, to get recordings of the remembrances of important people who will not be writing their memoirs, to get them down on tape and to get them into the historical record. He really is very much Americanized in his style, Mr. Lin, an aggressive executive. He too said he would be quite willing to talk to me again. He had a person in the room who didn't talk much, but who was apparently a subordinate of his, who used to be an aide of General Giap of the North Vietnamese Army. It would certainly be interesting to learn something from him. He seemed a bit shy. Bill asked a rather pointed question of me.